Hello and welcome to the Untalented podcast. I'm welcomed today by Chris Moody. It's good to have you.
Thanks, man.
How are you doing?
See, I'm doing really well. I'm in a good mood. It's been sunny.
It has been sunny. I know. Whenever people are listening to this, London has had some sunshine. So that's good. But yeah, it's great to have Chris here today. He's currently the global ECD of Landor. I think that we've got loads to chat about with there. But I was actually looking at your LinkedIn this morning and in your previous to one role at Wolf Olins, you were there, you started as a senior designer,
yeah,
which I think is remarkable, and then moved all the way up to be the most senior sort of creative leader in that business, which, you know, I'm sure you've got loads of stories and I've got loads of questions prepared to ask you about that. And then went to McKinsey, which is a really interesting move, and now doing the sort of global ECD role at Landor. So yeah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. Good to be here.
We'll start with the question we usually ask, which is, who is the first person to make you feel talented?
It's probably the answer everyone gives, but my mom. My mom isn't the answer that everybody gives, obviously.
Yeah.
She's probably the only person that has fundamentally, at any point in time, always had that 100% belief.
Mm.
100% belief. We were a single parent family. It was just me and my brother and her. And there isn't a moment in time where I don't think she's ever thought we could do anything on the planet.
Mm.
In terms of people who kind of inspired me later on, one of those people was a guy called Richard Doust. Richard Doust used to run Central St. Martin's.
Okay.
And I actually went in having not got into the Royal College, and I was gutted. Like, my head was on the floor.
Mm.
And he gave me a chance beyond the deadline and allowed me in to do the master's course at Central St. Martin's.
Wow.
Changed my life. Like, fundamentally changed my life, just the belief by looking at the portfolio and said, go for it.
Yeah. Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, you're so right. We've had grandparents, teachers. I said this literally last week, but it seems in those formative years of your life as a creative person that it's so important to have someone in your life who believes in you. Mm-hmm. It seems like people get to a place where they take the chance on being creative, almost. I think we're all inherently creative as human beings, but it seems like that's a really important part.
I think it's a really critical part. I think any really good creative organization feels a bit like a family, mm. like an extended family. And definitely having that kind of love at the heart of whatever you do is fundamental to great creativity.
Yeah,
you can't do great creative work unless you love what you're doing. And you have to feel kind of loved and like you're a family or a gang to be able to do that.
Yeah. Were your family creative? Like, did your mum have a creative role or?
No, not at all. There's kind of irony. My very old uncle once gave me a book called How to Draw, which I've still got. And I got a version and gave it to my daughter, who's 7. Didn't realise the majority of it is kind of life drawing examples, which is probably not as appropriate now. But what was great about it was there's just this spirit of, look, you can do anything, just try it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, come back and try something else.
So how did you realise design or creativity was even an option?
It's a good question, because for a long time, I don't think I really believed that I could make a career of it. I worked at various places, worked at Sony Europe, where I was a really terrible packaging designer. and then I was actually given a role outside of Central St. Martin's. Again, Richard Doust helped me get this, working for a company called Kuiden Postma.
Okay.
They're based in Amsterdam. And I went over to go do a magazine with them out there that folded on the first day. But they kept me. And I stayed there. And I think that was the first time that I felt this is the thing that I want to be doing.
Mm.
And they were like a family. Like, they had a beautiful studio right on the river. And people used to just come in and out, and it's run by these two guys, Paul and Jacques. They were just kind of smart, interesting people who wanted to do amazing creative stuff.
Mm.
And were really passionate about it. And it was just a great period of time to learn from probably some of the best graphic designers definitely in the world.
Yeah, wow. So a small part of your early design career was spent in Amsterdam.
Yeah. Yeah, and with no money, and just kind of wandering around and traveling and meeting people. And actually, some of the people I met then appeared later on in my life.
Really?
Wolf Olins, or, you know, since. And it's a really great place to go learn. because there's a really open spirit. The work is exceptional. Mm. Like some of the best design that comes out of Amsterdam still to this day. And it's just a brilliant place to go kind of learn your trade and the basics.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think that, people have such interesting stories from the start of their career. I think that, you know, is that a non-traditional start to your career? Probably, you know, moving around and going to Amsterdam. I think that, what do you think, what was the industry like then? Like, in comparison to now, what do you think is the most significant difference?
It was a lot less planned and more accidents kind of happened and positive accidents happened. Like, just to be clear, I was like a really reluctant traveller. I was not a great traveller.
Really?
I lived in Yorkshire for 19 years and I was, you know, my aforementioned mum pushed me out the door to go to university in Liverpool. And I was reluctant. I liked living at home. I was kind of comfortable. But weirdly, the career that I chose allowed me to be able to travel and meet kind of strange people. I spent time in Israel and like an amazing kind of learning process of going out there and spending time at the Vital Art School. And it was all to do with kind of accident and bumping into people. And you find that the more times you open yourself up to do things different, the more amazing things are going to happen. Mm. And you find all these kind of weird and interesting people to hang out with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also it's like Amsterdam at that time, I'm sure, was a very creative city, but was it a very design orientated city?
Yeah, I think so. I think it remains so, but even then it felt very special. And what was really nice was all of the different design houses all hung out with each other.
Mm.
So you'd go for drinks and you go meet people from Dunbar or, you know, but just all these amazing talents that are just bumbling into each other.
Yeah.
And sharing stories. And I think maybe that's one thing that's got a little less common is people just kind of spending time with what you'd call their competition, right?
Yeah.
It's nice to hang out with people who do the same thing as you.
Yeah.
And you can learn a lot.
Well, I mean, you'll know better than anyone. It's the global design market is fiercely competitive now. And I think that, I think that you're so right. The idea of hanging out with other designers, regardless of like, you know, it's like after a rugby game, you go and have a beer together. I think
exactly what you should feel like.
Was that your first big break then in the way you felt like, okay, this is what I want to do?
No, it didn't really feel like that because then I came back after being out in Amsterdam and I sort of didn't know what to do myself. And I hadn't really got a master plan. It wasn't like I was working through a big career plan. And I ended up looking through the business pages. And that was back in the day when you kind of have a yellow pages and then like an orange pages with the businesses.
Wow.
And I was flicking through design studios and I flicked from a back and Wolf Ollins was there, obviously, W. And I gave him a call and organized to go and show my portfolio. And I went and shared my portfolio with the person who then went on to become my creative director. I think he'd had a couple of drinks. But he invited me back the next week and then a couple of other conversations. And then they offered me a role and I stayed for 18 years.
Yeah, wow.
And it was never planned. It was just one of those things that happened and was fortuitous, you know, that the right people were there at the right time. But that felt like a big break. That felt different. That felt special. I remember walking into the floor for the very first time and it just felt like this hub of activity and stuff going on. And even when I look back now, the things that were happening at that point were kind of epic brands that you would recognize and know and love.
Yeah.
It felt special.
Yeah, that is very cool. I mean, it's such a Wolf Ollins is such a, you know, well-known, you know, it's got so much pedigree. And I think that it's stood the test of time, really, hasn't it, as a business?
It has. And I think but one of the reasons is that it's not the same place. We always used to talk about it's a little bit like a football team in so much as every few years, a whole new crop of talent come in and gradually kind of they become the dominant team and then people drift away.
Yeah.
You know, I was there for 18 years. That's a long time to be anywhere. And I rode lots of successive waves of different people taking leadership and eventually was lucky enough to do that myself. But the truth was that eventually you have to kind of give way to whoever's coming next in that team, right? You can't be, you know, striker at 45.
No, that's true. You've got to go and be a manager somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. And I think that I imagine, because how big was Wolf Ollins then?
I think when I joined, it was kind of like 250-300 people.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's much
and
bigger.
Over kind of four floors and, you know, very large. But I think what they did well and continue to do well is that we almost have a limit of not getting too big.
Mm.
Or at least doing it in a way that manages that kind of spirit.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a completely different world to then go and working in a consultancy.
Well, exactly. And that will kind of move us nicely on. But I don't know why. I just didn't feel like it would be that big at that point. But I guess it had been around still for...
Yeah. And there's a lot of iterations of it over years of various kind of scales and sizes. I think also any big design studio kind of goes with the culture that it finds itself in.
Mm.
You know, growing and kind of rising and dropping to fit the culture that it belongs in at that moment in time. And, you know, when I first joined, there was a lot of need around particular specialisms. So specialisms around things like experience, which ironically have kind of come back up again and are really, really prominent. So it's interesting to see how places change over that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's, what a great, like, story. And I think that being there for that long, you probably, you know, were so integral in making it what it probably is now, you know, which must be strange to think about.
It is strange. And it's kind of strange leaving. So I imagine, again, you know, I'm not a big footballer, but I've mentioned football three times, but it is kind of like when you leave a place and go, you know, leave Man United and go play for Man City. Mm. It's an unusual thing to be on a different side. It's amazing how quickly you then become a kind of key player in another place.
Mm, yeah.
I was surprised by how quickly you can step away and look at it with more kind of rose-tinted eyes, and it's just part of your heritage.
Mm, yeah, well, I mean, we'll spend a little bit of time about talking about Landor, because that's obviously where you're working now. I guess, what is your current role? Like, what do you spend your time doing?
It's global, and it's genuinely global. And I think the interesting thing for me was joining somewhere that had, you know, we've got a lot of studios. There's kind of 30-odd studios. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different kind of client needs in all of those different regions. I've always loved travel. As I've got older, like you had to be forced out of a door originally, and now I kind of love being on a plane, or I love kind of seeing different new places. And there's something really great about having a set of studios that we can work together and do things in completely different ways. You can bring together the Singapore studio with the US studio, or you can speak to the guys in Hamburg and they've got a perspective on stuff which is different from the guys in Tokyo.
Mm.
And I've never been able to quite have that amount of access, and that's exciting. It does mean that kind of like the days are busy and filled full of waking up, and you speak to one side of the world and then you go to bed, you speak to the other side of the world. But I think the spirit of studio life is true across every single destination. And they all feel like they're all part of that same family.
Mm.
And I'm not quite sure how we managed to pull that off, but there's something really great about that spirit runs through everywhere. When you arrive through the door, you know that you're in our place.
Mm.
And that's something you can't force. It happens kind of naturally as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still staggers me how big Landor actually is globally. I think that a lot of people don't really realize that, you know, the volume of offices even you've got.
But I think part of it for me is that ability to be able to have specialisms. So there's quite a lot of people because there's a lot of specialisms. And we've got, you know, we work with guys at AMP who are now part of our family. And obviously, you know, there's some amazing work with Man vs. Machine that are part of our family as well. And we are able to pull on all these different levers to solve client problems. And it's less to do with kind of scale, but to do with that kind of breadth.
Mm.
And I kind of think that the strength is this ability to be able to tell a story from end to end and pull on the right levers and the right experts to help you tell that story.
Yeah. I love asking this question, but how would you describe your role to a child?
I have to explain to a child all the time. So I've got a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old. I think one thing is I'm there to help tell stories. So whenever I try explaining to Coco and Matilda, I say, look, daddy's job is to go and tell stories. And sometimes I tell stories with pictures, and sometimes I tell stories with words. And then often I just kind of boil it down to, yes, we did that logo. But I think it's about conversation and storytelling. That's my kind of big focus over the last few years of trying to get away from, am I really a designer anymore, or am I kind of a designer who's moved into a kind of strategic mindset, or no, I'm a storyteller and I do that on behalf of clients. Mm. And I need to understand them and spend time with them and grasp what their challenge are, and then find a way to be able to bring that story to life in a brand new way.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the reason I love that question so much is because I think sometimes we all get a bit obsessed with over-glamorizing what we do. And, you know, the nature of that is obviously obvious. But there is something really, you know, childlike about creating pictures and telling stories. And
Completely. And it's a joy, and it's like it's a privilege, right? We get to make things up for a living. And if we do our jobs really, really well, we make things up that have never been seen before. It's still exciting. Like, after all this time, there's still kind of like a drive. You get that kind of buzz or that thing in your stomach when you see something, you think, that is the route. Mm-hmm. That is the story we're going to tell. This is going to land really well. And you get that feeling that nothing beats it.
Yeah.
Nothing beats it.
Yeah. So obviously we went from Wolf Olins to Landor. There was a really interesting period in the middle where you went to McKinsey. I'd love to, like, because not that many people do that, I don't think. I think that going to a consultancy as a creative person could be seen as a faux pas, maybe. Yeah. What drove that decision? Kind of, how did you get to that point?
I think I watched too much Succession. I think I got really excited by the idea of being involved in business. And I think I've always had that. There's a bit of me that kind of, I always feel a little bit disappointed when I speak to designers and they say they don't want to have anything to do with this more commercial side of what we do, right? Mm. We're technically commercial artists, so there is a role in it. And I think there's something quite exciting potentially of kind of understanding that world a little bit better so that you can do more creative stuff. It's not that I ever wanted to kind of, you know, go off and become a full-time business consultant forever.
Mm.
But it's a world that I found kind of fascinating, and it's influential on how we do things. So every brief that anybody has ever been given has probably been formed along with people like McKinsey or Bain or Deloitte. They've been in the room helping fashion that brief. So it kind of felt exciting to go, well, let me get in there as well and work out how that brief is formed and what decisions that are made, and how can I help influence it to make it more able to create more creative stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a culture shock, right? It's a completely different way of working. The where you work in a management consultancy is much more kind of SAS style. You come in, you do 6 weeks, you work really hard. It is long hours, but then you have, you know, a few weeks to kind of take a breath and work out what your next project's going to be. Mm. And there's no doubt about it. It's hard and it's different, but it was a really exciting time, and I took lots of really good learnings from it. Mm. And it made me kind of appreciate the side of what we do that has a tremendous impact on people, which is, okay, fundamentally understanding how we're going to convert that creative idea into something that's going to have longevity, it's going to have meaning, it's going to have an impact for people. It was a real interesting move.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, even just looking at office to office, you know, being in that environment, I'm sure that was a shift. What were you brought in to do?
Yeah, so I'd worked with McKinsey for about 3 or 4 years doing their brand.
Okay.
So I knew them pretty well, or thought I did. And then they asked me to come and join as what they called a senior advisor and help them build a brand capability for clients. So essentially doing like a mini agency within McKinsey, helping solve brand challenges and brand problems. And that's exactly what I did. And we started off as a small little team of us, and it grew over time, and the guys have continued and will continue, I'm sure, to do amazing stuff. And we worked on some really kind of interesting, complex challenges for like a real mixed bag of clients. One of the weird things was I was given an office, which was always like my kind of big dream of like, oh, right, I get an office. And then I remember the first day I got in the office, and I sat when it got to about 12:15, and I thought, really lonely. I really miss studio life. Yeah. Like it. So eventually it was kind of something that I'd left behind. But there's something really, really exciting about being in a room with those senior people and having a voice, and that voice being about brand.
Mm.
And every CEO that I've ever met, be it McKinsey or any other place, even recently, they all want to know about branding and design because it's something they don't do on a daily basis. Mm. It's always the thing, they come in the room and they take off their tie and go, okay, just teach me. Let me know what all this is about because I don't get it. Mm. So that was kind of nice because you always knew that the clients wanted to hear from you. And I think that remains true.
Yeah. And I think also there's obviously some super smart, very, you know, successful people who hang out in that environment, but no one in that building was better than you at what you were there to be brought in for. And I think
it was always nice to have that killer cred of kind of like, well, you know, you'd be presenting to a client and then you'd also say, and I also did the identity and expression and for our company. And it was just kind of like a nice ability to be able to say, okay, I clearly know my stuff.
Yeah. Did you have any sort of areas that, like, because consultancies are notorious for creating periods of conflict to enable, you know, better things to come as a result. Did you ever have any moments where you were like, cool, this is quite tough?
Yeah, I think I remember actually the first moment of that was my mentor who brought me in. He, you know, would check in with me every few weeks. And I remember about 3-4 weeks in, bearing in mind that I joined not far off kind of COVID time as well. So it was a weird time to be around. And I got some time with him. I said, look, I'm not sure whether I'm doing the right things or whether I should, you know, how I should be approaching each of these different projects. And he just said, I'm not your dad. and he was like, oh my God. But it was the best thing he could have ever said.
Yeah.
And what he really meant was, look, this place thrives on people being entrepreneurial. Mm. It thrives on people ringing someone up and asking them something.
Yeah.
So if you're quiet and things aren't working the way that you want them, change it and like hit phones, bring some people up. And it was the best piece of advice. Well, it wasn't really advice. It was kind of a bit of a slap. It was the right thing to do. And it was a really good learning of make the change happen yourself.
Mm.
There's so many amazing people there. And they're just a phone call or a text message away, and everyone will always pick up a phone to you.
Mm.
They'll always give you 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and that was a big learning from that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that kind of harsh feedback is often like a bit of a slap in the face. You're like, wow, that's woken me up a bit.
Yeah.
I find it interesting because when you sort of mention something, how designers are sometimes not bothered or interested in the kind of more business side of it, and I think that. How is there an education piece that needs to happen? Is it involving people in conversations around the commerciality of design?
There's a couple of things. There's one thing which is like breaking down the kind of complexity. It's not that complex, right? I haven't got a business degree. Yeah, I managed to survive there and kind of unpick things. And they do this thing where they allow you to work through virtually every job in the business. So you work as an analyst and then you're working kind of putting together the program planning. That was super useful because it was really, really, really helpful. I think sometimes, and I was guilty of this in the past, particularly when I was younger, of a kind of willful naivety to say, well, I don't want to be involved in any of that commercial stuff because it all feels a little bit kind of grubby and kind of all about the cash. And actually, that's not true. It's about understanding why maybe a client will make a decision. It's about maybe understanding why they would prefer to go with something that might feel less creative.
Mm.
Because they're making decisions based on other criteria as well. And it's kind of like, it's like saying, no, it's like reading a book, but choosing deliberately not to read the vowels, right? It's like, you can read it and get to the end, but you won't get a full sense of really what the story is. And I always thought it was a really good way to gain knowledge in service of doing more creative thinking.
Yeah.
And more creative work. It's not in contrast to it. I think the same is true from data. So we have at Lando, we have a brand performance team. They're the best partners of the creative team. I used to hate looking at the idea of doing things like testing. Actually, if you understand it and kind of get involved with people who really, really understand it, it can be super helpful for the most creative thinking.
Mm.
And I know that could sound kind of dull, but it's one of the few ways to make sure in this world now with like all the eyes that go on any kind of creative project, that you're going to be able to get through the thing that is the most cut through, passionate, amazing, is to be able to bring something with you to help prove that on different levels.
Mm. Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think that you often hear people talk about design being problem solving, solving problems, and it's not art. You know, art is some. But I think that there will be some people who join the industry who are wanting to create art maybe and not wanting to solve problems. And I think that the commerciality of design means that you have to be solving problems for your clients.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think it stops you from being artistic. I think that's okay, but there is at the end of the day, like a client pays you money to solve a problem or help them do something they can't do. Mm. And sometimes that will require the art, and sometimes it's going to require the science. But most of the time, it requires a little bit of both. Mm. So being able to have even just a kind of cursory knowledge of like why they're making their decisions is really helpful, I think.
I think, yeah, I mean, the stark difference, well, even the word consultancy for designers will probably be like, whoa, I don't want to be in that environment. But as you say, it's like that brief or that exciting project that you've got has often flowed through that environment. So yeah. We've spoken a lot about this and we'll kind of move on, but what was the most significant difference that you felt at McKinsey in comparison to obviously being at Wolf Olins?
I think pace. I think it was fast, fast pace. And it felt really, really hard. Maybe there was more hierarchy than you would have in a studio. Mm-hmm. I think studios are pretty kind of open in terms of their hierarchy now. And that was a learning curve to get used to that again. And, you know, you'd have a senior partner come in who was, frankly, like a world expert on a specific topic. Mm. And it's hard to completely contradict them because they probably have got the right answer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was a real difference. I miss studio culture. That was one of the things I did miss, to the point of kind of the corner office was great up until the point you had to sit in it. Studio culture is something that is unique to design world and the reason that kind of drew me back into it. Spend time with people, spend time in a creative environment, to go in every morning and see new things pinned up on a wall. Mm. That's the thing that probably is the biggest difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously then we'll get back onto Landor now, but you went from McKinsey, spent some great time there, to Landor. What were you brought in to do at Landor?
Really just come in and kind of have a really clear creative perspective. Come in and be able to help make the most of some of the amazing talent we've got. I've been to a lot of places. I've spent a lot of time with a lot of creative people. I think this, the group of people that we work with on a daily basis, and I mean this kind of globally, the level of talent is extraordinary. Mm. Like really cut through different crazy minds coming together. I think be able to amplify that.
Yeah.
Be able to help tell that story of a change in organization. Like Landor's a different place now than it was a few years ago, and that's good. It needs to keep moving forward to move along with the clients. I think my job is to help elevate both the work and the people. Mm. And you can't do one without the other.
Yeah, that is true. And so obviously a big part of your role is raising the craft, raising the level of design. How do you go around doing that? There obviously isn't a special kind of magic special source to do that, but what's your method generally?
I really like being in the studio or spending time with people, which is why I end up on planes quite a lot, or it's also why I end up being in the studio every single day. I think that's because there's something about it feeling like a shared endeavor. Like all of creativity is about shared. Right? Mm. It's like you're sharing something with the client, you're sharing something with the world, you're sharing time with each other to create something. And doing more of that is the thing that I feel like gets to the best results. So I like spending time with people. We do try to do proper crits when we can. That's something that kind of during COVID time fell out, I think, a little bit. I think we'd like to spend time really analysing what the problem is. Like, what are the problem we're really trying to solve? Not the thing that was kind of on the brief that was co-written by Bain, but like, what's the thing that we actually want to solve and where's the cut through come from? And then also just taking that step back and having that ability to be able to say, okay, have we pushed it as far as we can possibly go? Is there something that we can do that will take this from something that's great to something that's next level? Mm. And that comes through talking. It comes through critiques. It comes through looking at the work, solving that brief, writing it down, doing it over and over again. A lot of time in the studio.
Yeah, it's, again, people who ever listened to some of the last podcasts that I recorded, I was referencing an agency who they're notorious for doing great work, and I asked one of the design directors, what's the secret? And they were like, we work really, really hard. And I was like, oh, that's not the answer that I wanted. But I think especially with Landor's going through a period of time right now, from my perspective, of real excitement in the industry. You know, there's some, you being one of them, some really interesting, probably non-conventional hires that the business is making. And I think that, was that a sort of purposeful move from the business?
I feel so. I mean, being part of it makes it a little bit weird to comment on, but like, you take my friend Tamu, so chief creative officer, amazing talent. Mm. That's coming from Meta. He's got a perspective on the world which is like nobody else's, and the level of expectation of craft behind that work is higher than anyone I've ever worked with. But also I think there's a group of people coming in, even at an intern level, that are most super talented people I've met, and just smart, wise people that are bringing something completely different. And I think our recruitment, particularly at a graduate intern level, is unbeatable.
Mm.
And I can't wait for the world to see the outcome of the work that they're doing with us.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so important, isn't it? That and I talk about this a lot, but the barrier to entry for designers to get into the design industry is higher than most other, you know, roles. You have to know your way around the creative suite. You have to be able to, you know, from a practical perspective, there's a lot that you need to learn to do that. How do you think, like, how have you guys done it? Is it sort of connecting with schools and universities, or?
Yeah, a combination. There's a lot of youth programs that we do connecting with kind of specific youth programs, or connecting with universities. I think also is just giving the opportunity for people to spend time with us and in the studio. Mm. So we always have 3, 4, 5 intern working with us.
Mm.
Being involved, genuinely involved in the work, not just coming to go and be a runner, because that doesn't help anyone. Like, come in and get involved and share the strengths that you have. I think also just really carefully reviewing people and ensuring they're getting out of the experience the best that they possibly can. Because sometimes people just want to talk and tell you, actually, you know what, I'd be better if you allow me to do this. Or did you know that I'm actually a fantastic illustrator, but nobody's asked me?
Yeah.
So I think just being open to allowing people to show their talent
is really
important.
I honestly speak to, you know, lots of CDs or creative directors or ECDs of design agencies who they'll often comment on, like, an amazing junior who's blown them away. Mm. And I think that's such a lovely thing to hear about, because, you know, it's the idea of like an older, more, you know, mature creative leader learning so much from a young person, I think is really nice to think about.
I think there's something, and maybe this just comes with being around for quite a while, but I'm not scared of anyone taking my job anymore. I think there's too many people in this industry that are worried about people taking their role. It's like, eventually someone's going to do it, and you know what, good luck to them, they'll be awesome, I'm sure. What I want to see is that the time that I spend in my studio, people grow,
mm.
and people do things that push the kind of boundaries of what the expectation is that they could have done.
Mm.
That's the job of a senior leader. A senior leader should be there to facilitate the growth of the people in the business. And it's not just about monetary growth, it's about growth of careers. It's about, you know, if you're starting to lose people to different agencies because they're moving super quick, it's probably because you're doing a pretty good job of like making them feel like they're doing the best work they can.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's just there's lots of things, and I think that it's a people are often scared of like the unknown or like what they don't know about, and I think that the seeing younger designers come into the industry with loads of skills that it feels impossible for them to possess, I think it's probably quite intimidating to be honest. But talking about challenges, what do you think, what is the, from a design industry or agency perspective, what are some challenges that the industry is facing at the
Miro boards. They're the biggest challenge to creativity right now. They're super useful, right? Don't get me wrong, but they should be like Snapchat. they should disappear after every job. The idea that you carry around these kind of mirror boards of ideas that then get lumped on for different projects, it's not the way to create amazing stuff. And I also think this, and it comes from maybe a bit of a COVID hangover of fragmentation, people working in different places and not spending time with each other. And what happens sometimes is that you start to drift apart. And if you drift apart, you start to kind of replicate things that are safe.
Mm.
And I think the biggest challenge we face is studios not behaving like studios, just behaving like hubs where people drop in every now and again. And this isn't about getting people kind of back to work. It's not about that at all. It's about people spending time with each other because the work gets better, because you challenge each other, because you flag something that you've seen before. Like in McKinsey, they talk about risk mitigation.
Mm.
Risk mitigation is just making sure that there's not someone in one studio and someone in another studio doing the same thing. And the best way to do that is share work among each other rather than work in little silos. My biggest worry is that there'll be a continued fragmentation of people working just without talking.
Yeah. I mean, that's the I personally enjoy being around people and, you know, and meeting different people. And I think that if I was a completely remote person, I would really struggle. I would actually be lonely. You know, it's like, it's not even just about enjoying my job. I would feel lonely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously you commented earlier about wanting to spend time with people creatively. There is a large amount of designers who like working alone. Yeah. And I think that, yes, that's fine. You know, that's fine but I don't know if that works for junior people. I don't know if that works for mid-weight designers. I'm not sure.
I think it's hard. I think it's hard. And I think also it's like in service of what, right? So any piece of work that I can think of, this is why I always feel a little bit weird talking about work and like it's my work. It's not my work. It's all shared work. Everything I've ever done in my career is because of a bunch of stakeholders that I have. Those stakeholders are people like my mom, people like my wife and my kids who enable me to do it. They're also the people that I've worked with over all that time, the Jacques and Pauls of Quidden Postma, still having an influence on my work now. That are people I work with at Landor on a daily basis. It's a shared endeavor. Mm. It's not something you can do on your own. And the idea that you can wander around with a portfolio and say, look at my work, it's not your work. It's a collective whole of all of the people that you've ever spent time with.
Mm.
And that's a much more interesting story than look at my work.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never even thought about it like that. And I think that it's really nice because actually even if you are like a solo freelancer, you've still learned from somewhere and someone. So I like that.
I think it's something to be celebrated. You know, it's a collective enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that I speak about this a lot in terms of sort of like sector defining work or work that's kind of a complete offshoot into a different direction. Is there anything that, and I've sort of sprung this question on you, so you're welcome, but is there anything you've noticed recently or a brand that you're like, that has really defined that sector?
I think there's lots of amazing stuff happening. I mean, obviously the work that like Uncommon are doing, I find kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of pushes the boundaries of stuff. I like it when stuff gets crossed over. So there was something our Milan studio did for Milan Orchestra, which was a combination of typography and sonic together. And it created something that was a bit like concrete poetry. It was kind of like this amazing mashup of look and feel and behavior, and I really like that. I like things that kind of bring together two sides that you wouldn't normally expect to belong in the same place.
Mm.
And also things that are actually just I work a lot with our product team, so our product team makes stuff. Jack Holloway and his team are some of the most talented people like in our building, and one of the things they've just done is, I think it's going to be like launched probably next week, is basically this thing called accessories, which is just a simple device that you attach to your toothbrush to enable people who haven't got great dexterity to brush their teeth.
Wow.
It's like a small idea with a huge impact, and it looks super cool. And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that gets me excited, is the ability to kind of think of a problem and then think of a completely alternate way of solving that problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I can't remember who I was speaking to about this, but they... the reason they moved into a sort of like product design environment was because an uncle of theirs had like a sort of challenges with, I think they had like learning difficulties or something, and she was watching them use like a Sainsbury's or a, like a to order your shopping, and couldn't quite understand like the amount of stuff. So they ordered like 27 pints of milk or something, and that was the sort of reason for being like, how do we make this thing more inclusive for people, actually everyone, to be able to use this? Because, you know, if you think about people who might be ordering their shopping or groceries to their own home, it might be someone who's disabled. So actually that should be a accessible product. So I find that really interesting, that world.
Yeah. I mean, it was, again, was some lovely stuff that was done with aerial packaging, but the team worked on, but it had this little eco-click thing, which was, again, like a dexterity thing to enable people to safely be able to close a box of washing powder, because obviously you don't want kids getting hold of it, but also you want people to be able to access it if they need to access it.
Yeah.
So designing a product, a solution to a real challenge, that's exciting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm curious to talk with you about the sort of future of branding or brands. I think that we've spoken a little bit about this before. And I think when we last met, we spoke about the impact of AI. I know everyone's going to go, God, why are we talking about AI again? But I think it's actually fascinating, some of the stuff that we've discussed before. Yeah. What do you think is the most noticeable change that designers will see, or that we'll all notice about the impact of AI?
I think probably the important thing is it's already happened, right? It's already in the process of just working its way through to the day-to-day level, but it's already kind of having an impact. I think it's potentially super exciting because it's going to allow us to do more creativity. It's going to make creativity more abundant if it's done well. And the reason for that is that it allows a lot of the practical things like guidelines, right, to be able to be done better. So the idea that AI can help, you know, they're golden for guidelines because they enable you to be able to structure and, you know, keep control of something in a way that was intended in the most purest sense, which is really kind of useful if you're a creative who really cares about making sure that your idea is kind of protected and gets out in the world in the best way possible. I think there's something equally interesting around, by making creativity more abundant, making creativity more kind of accessible and more of it happen, then you can do more creative work. So a friend of mine from McKinsey, Ben, he used to use this analogy about water. So water used to be something, particularly in the Western world, that wasn't very abundant. Therefore, creative people did things to protect it. They kept it inside little jars and they kept it in pipes. Then when water became more abundant, they enabled them to be able to do something different and more imaginative. It's when fountains were created. It's when swimming pools were created. And that's the moment we're at now. Like, creativity is going to be made really, really abundant by AI. It's going to enable lots and lots of different types of creativity to happen. Our job is to respond to that and do with it the most exciting, most creative things. Be really kind of mind-blowing about what we use that function for, not be scared by it. Because the truth is, it's happened before. Like when we, just after I'd started at Wolf Olins many, many moons ago, I think the last few parallel motion boards were taken out of the building. Parallel motion boards used to be where you go and you draw things out on your kind of transfer paper. And I remember guys saying, these Macs won't replace these. This is about craft and care and detail. And it happened and everyone was fine. And amazing creative work came out of that studio. So it's not something that scares me at all.
I mean, it's the translation of different methods of working is sort of, it will continue to happen for the rest of time, I would assume. One interesting thing, I don't know how much you can say on this either, but machine learning, in my mind, is a very mathematical thing that doesn't scream creativity. However, when we spoke last time, you mentioned the creative uses of machine learning within branding. What does that look like?
I think the best way to think about it is it just allows greater volume of exploration, right? You can do more things with it. So it can enable you to test the boundaries of an idea and push it as far as you could possibly go. But it still needs us to edit it. And that's a crucial thing, right? The most important thing that AI can't do is get the most right wrong answer. And that's what our job is as designers. It's like find the answer that on the surface looks wrong, but actually is the most right and most suitable. And I think we'll always have a job if that's what we're kind of looking for. Create things that have never been created before. Find the thing that is beyond that algorithm. We've got to look beyond kind of like the algorithms for the right answers.
Mm.
But they can be a tool, and they can be a useful tool to help us kind of push creativity as far as it'll go.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think it's the idea that brands can evolve themselves, or you know, can sort of learn what is right for a consumer of that brand, or what doesn't resonate. I think is really fascinating. It feels like we're in like the year 3000 or something. Just even thinking about that. I mean, if you could have explained to a 19-year-old Chris what the industry would be like now, what do you think his reaction?
The first thing I say to him is just chill out a little bit. Don't worry, it's all going to be all right. I think I probably was a bit of a Luddite back then. I wasn't really looking to technology to help me solve problems. I saw it as a thing that was getting in the way of like the purity of a craft. And actually that craft can just be enhanced. So yeah, I think my advice to him would be embrace it, because there's plenty more of it, and it can only help you if you use it right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is fascinating. I think that but design is so notoriously, you know, you've got really passionate kind of people who love the it's like people who like collecting vinyls, isn't it? There's that same kind of mentality around design and, you know, the history of it. And I think that's so important, because it allows people, you know, really beautiful reference points, or, you know, to be sticking to a process which has clearly worked. But, you know, I love the idea of being able to say to yourself, just honestly lean into this, because it is going to help you. Because the problem with not leaning into it is you get left behind, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you, no one wants to be that person who, or agency or business or designer who gets left behind when everyone else is kind of sailing off into this kind of really interesting creative you know, area. I'm fascinated also by, obviously at Landor you've got such a wealth and breadth of experience, and you know, with the kind of combination of Fitch, which is doing interesting things. I mean, what is there been a moment where you've seen something being done, or you've kind of been on a fly on the wall and thought, wow, I've not seen stuff like this before?
Yeah, I mentioned the Milan studio again only because it's kind of fresh in my mind, but they did some work for Elica, which is a company that creates cooker hoods,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
And basically the whole job was kind of, how do you make a brand that can tell the story of something that kind of sucks life out of a room? And they made the most beautiful, elegant thing I've ever seen, and it was all about, actually, this is a machine that is helping us in our lives. So they went right back to kind of looking at retrofuturism and pulling all these stories from kind of like Italian art movements.
Wow.
And it was just so perfect, because it was actually just chiming with the true challenge, which is, this is a really simple device that has a really crucial role in your home. And it's kind of machine and life coming together in this really beautiful way.
Wow.
Yeah. Seek that one out, because it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I mean, I think that with that scale and the breadth, that you then get to engage with so much variety that you probably haven't had before, really, have you?
Yeah, that's been the true joy, being able to work with the brand performance team and thing, look at kind of how we can project how a brand's going to behave in a world, but also work with Jack's team in terms of product. Like we work together on identity projects, so we'll just build, here's what the product might look like in 30 years' time. Oh, by the way, here's a new logo on it. And find different ways to be able to use that stretch to be creative and mindful about what things really feel like.
Yeah.
That's what brands should do really well. You should be able to feel it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the thing that would, you know, this is me talking like I'm a designer, which I'm not, but I think the thing that would really impact me as someone who'd been mostly in an identity world would be like the tangible aspects of the things that you create, you know, the things that people can use or hold, or, you know, a tote bag. But do you know what I mean? It's like, I think that that would really resonate with me, those things.
I mean, that is how we do... You know, if we're doing an identity brief, right, we're working on one at the moment, we never start with, okay, this is a story behind your logo. It's always, okay, let's imagine a person who uses your brand on a daily basis. What's the first thing they might see? What do you feel like when you turn up at CES? What do you feel like when you're engaging with talent for the first time? And it's about prototyping these different opportunities. And that's how you seed the brand in. Just starting with the page of, okay, here's your new logo. I think people are kind of moved beyond it a little bit. They want to be able to experience and feel the brand. And brands are multidimensional now. They have lots of different kind of ways in which you can kind of interact with them, be that sonic, be that motion, you know, finding ways through UX and UI. And all of that is one story. It's just a different side of the brand that you experience at different times.
Yeah. This is another sort of thing that has just come into my mind. I think that the... How do you as a agency measure the impact of your work? So, for example, you know, client comes to you, we want to create this, you know, brand, so we want to evolve. How do you, is it their response to it, or is it how does that work?
It's a combination of things, because that's the other side of a brand. It's multidimensional in the way it talks to the world. It's also multidimensional in the way that it, you know, you can judge its success. So we go out and speak to audiences afterwards. We speak with internal clients, and I think thinking of eBrand much more like something as this editable software, but over time can be adapted and changed. Well, it seems nuts, right? But you would actually do a rebrand of something every 5 years and then just leave it alone. It's just, it's just not going to be appropriate, right? You're going to need to tweak and fiddle with it. And testing, and testing in a way that projects rather than just tells you, you know, a bunch of data that you can't act upon because it's about the past is really useful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Don't worry about that as well. We'll carry on a little bit more. Okay, interesting. I'm moving on to the last section of the podcast. I think that, I guess we can get a little bit down memory lane, but do you have like a specific memorable moment or like a piece of work that really stands out to you?
Yeah, and there's a theme obviously coming through everything that I talked about, but it is about people. So I worked with Virgin Media for a long time, and it was primarily because of one person, a guy called Ade Spooner, who was a really good friend. He passed away, and you know, think about him a lot. And one of the fundamental reasons why the experience of working with him was so good is he was a client who felt like a member of a team. And we spent so much time together, and we rebranded Virgin Media 3 times, and we went to events together, and we just did stuff that felt like it was a true kind of partnership. And those sort of things, they don't come along too often. And that's memorable because it's some of the best work ever created. It was a tiny little job that he came in, can we just polish the logo? And years later, we're still working with them. Virtually every job of significance that I've done since has been, had him involved in some way, whether it's kind of through contacts of contacts or, and I think that's why I still get out of bed and get excited about branding and design, is because of people like that, you know, people who fundamentally inspire you to want to do better work. I happen to be a client. It could have been someone that I, you know, had worked with in the office, but that those sort of things are the reason why I remember jobs. I remember people more than I remember the work.
Yeah,
because the typeface could always be better.
Yeah. Well, I guess, and I think that's it's a really interesting thing to consider, isn't it? Because the whole why do we all do this? Is it's making memories with human beings, right? Yeah. That seems to me what is the most noticeable thing, but. With the amount of criticism that work gets in the industry and the amount of, you know, media stuff that happens, I think that firstly, that must be difficult, especially when it's like the first period of experiencing that feedback. But if you're able to say, that's that project done now and we can, you know, then I think that's a good way to be.
Yeah. I think for me, I'm sort of channeling my inner Monty Don today, but there's something about, for me, a really good project, it's like gardening, right? It's like gardening. The aim of doing a good project is that you create something for people. So it will take you time and effort and craft, but you're creating it for people to kind of enjoy and spend time with. You have to fundamentally build it for an environment that you're in and understand that environment, like really get it. What's the world in which it's been brought into? How's it going to fit alongside other brands? And then you're building it for a long term. You're going to build a brand, but it's going to continue to exist long after you've stopped being relevant or important. Mm. And having that kind of mindset of a brand is there to be something that is built for life and built to reflect life and the people in it, I think is something I stay true to.
Mm. Yeah, what a beautiful way to look at it. Well, I think that's we can close off on that. I think that was a lovely end to the podcast, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was brilliant to chat to you as always. And yeah, we'll see you again for the next one.
Thank you. Cheers.